From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said this morning that she was asking her committee chairman to draft articles of impeachment against President Trump.
Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit.
In a statement responding, the White House press secretary said Democrats should be ashamed, and President Trump looks forward to a fair trial in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans. Joining us now is California Congressman Eric Swalwell, a Democrat who sits on both the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, when will you start writing these articles of impeachment?
Well, we're receiving the report officially on Monday from the Intelligence Committee. And, you know, it lays out in the Intelligence Committee report a abuse of power by the president, obstruction of both Congress and justice in the way that the president has intimidated witnesses and, you know, has sought to conceal evidence. And we have to consider, you know, what are the best articles to tell the American people this president needs to be held accountable.
Do you think that the articles will extend beyond just the Ukraine situation, that there will also be articles of impeachment involving charges from special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation?
The Russia investigation and the way the president obstructed it shows us his pattern of conduct, meaning in the past he has asked a foreign government to participate in our elections. For example, when he said, "Russia, are you listening? Will you hack my opponent's emails?" And they were listening, and that day they sought to hack. So this is what he does. And so it's relevant to show that. It's still an open question as to, on the 10 counts of obstruction of justice that Bob Mueller laid out in the Russia investigation, if those would be included in our articles of impeachment.
You've said you want to keep it simple in scope.
Yes, I want to keep it simple. I think the Ukraine incident is one of urgency in that we have elections in fewer than 60 days in the primaries, and the president invoked the upcoming election and one of his opponents, and we have to act swiftly and we should stay focused.
How do you respond to the witness yesterday, Jonathan Turley, who says that Democrats are moving too quickly here, that they should take more time to investigate?
As Professor Turley said that Democrats are moving too quickly yesterday, Rudy Giuliani had quickly traveled over to Ukraine to meet with prosecutors who he had asked in the past to dig up dirt on Vice President Biden and his son. And so that concerns me. That shows the urgency here. You know, in Professor Turley's perfect world, you'd have a president who would turn over documents and allow witnesses to come forward. And the president hasn't done that. Despite that, we have 12 witnesses who did come forward through oral testimony. We have powerful evidence that the president used his office to ask a foreign government to cheat our elections.
Do you think that there will be more witnesses brought forward in hearings, or is that it?
The Intelligence Committee, we're still conducting an investigation. And, you know, I know I'll leave it to Chairman Schiff if he thinks anyone else needs to come in. But the Judiciary Committee is prepared now to receive the report that's been produced and start drafting up articles.
I want you to listen here to what your colleague on the Republican side in the Judiciary Committee, Andy Biggs, said on Fox News this morning.
But I think you're going to see several articles of impeachment so that there's a menu there so that some members can vote no for political purposes and then vote yes under the pressure of the speaker so that they can go back to their districts if they're in those 31 contested districts and say, hey, you know what? I viewed this carefully. I voted no on this article and this article, but, you know, I just felt evidence was important, so I voted yes on that.
He called that political shenanigans. What's your response to that?
Well, he's got a future in political analysis, I guess. But I have not heard us, you know, evaluate it that way. I was in a leadership meeting yesterday with Speaker Pelosi. And, you know, the focus is on what is the evidence? What does the Constitution demand us do about it? And, you know, the last thing any of us are looking at are, you know, day-to-day polls. Because, you know, this is too serious. It involves the Constitution of the United States, our duty to uphold it, and national security, you know, a foreign government. I think it was so powerful yesterday when the professors talked about our founders from the very beginning feared foreign involvement. And a salient point was that to even be president of the United States, no other office requires this, but to be president, you have to actually be born in the United States. That demonstrated their fear of outside interference. So this is a fear as long as our country and one that is present today.
Do you think this is all going to wrap up by Christmas?
There's no timeline, and that's intentional. We want to move based on, you know, the evidence and, you know, what our duty, you know, calls us to do. And we don't want to set artificial timelines. But because the upcoming elections and to make sure the process is fair, we're trying to move, you know, as expeditiously as possible and give the president an opportunity to participate. A little reported fact yesterday, after the Democratic and Republican questioning of witnesses, Chairman Nadler said this is the time where the president would be able to question the witnesses had he shown up. He was allowed to show up yesterday and he chose not to.
I want to ask you one more thing, which is that President Trump has been saying that this is going to become all too common. If he gets impeached now, this is going to become something that any party, the opposite party of the presidency, does to the president if they disagree with his policies or just don't like him. This will be the second, maybe third impeachment process that some Americans have lived through. Is that too much?
Well, in the Nixon case, you know, it worked. The right result occurred. Republicans joined Democrats. To the president's point, what I'm afraid of becoming all too common would be a president who would use his or her office to ask either foreigners or people in government to carry out, you know, their political priorities. And if we do nothing, I'm afraid that becomes the new standard.
That is Eric Swalwell, a Democrat from California who sits on the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well, NASA is having a big week. The space agency has revealed new discoveries from the Parker Solar Probe, which was launched last year on a mission to touch the sun. For eons, our star has been something of a mystery, even though it plays such a big role in our lives. But now it looks like we're starting to get some answers. NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield-Boyce is here. And Nell, this is a pretty gutsy move, sending a probe that close to the sun. What are we learning?
Well, it is gutsy, but if you want to send a probe to a star, this is pretty much our only chance right now. It's the closest star we've got. One of the things they want to understand is this mystery of why the sun's atmosphere is actually hotter than its surface. And that has been a mystery for decades, like 80 years, and it's so strange. It's almost as if you were around a campfire, and the further away you walked from the campfire, the hotter it got around you. Hmm. And so that's bedeviled scientists, and so they've been looking for a way that, you know, energy that heat might get dumped into the atmosphere. And through this probe, they're starting to see some hints. They're starting to see, you know, weird flipping magnetic fields and surges in the solar wind. That's the stream of charged particles that's constantly coming out of the sun. And so, you know, they're getting a lot of answers into some processes that have been mysterious up until now.
Okay, let's talk about the solar wind. Why does NASA care about that? What is it?
Well, you know, it's these particles coming from the sun, and, you know, they can be potentially damaging and dangerous. I mean, they can disrupt satellites, which, you know, as you know, a lot of our modern life depends on satellites these days for communications and GPS and that sort of thing. And they could also endanger astronauts. I mean, it's this idea of solar storms, solar weather, and trying to be better at predicting solar weather. So one of the findings from this probe is that the solar wind actually rotates around the sun a lot faster than anybody had realized it would. And having that kind of information will let them make better predictions about how the sun's activity could potentially affect Earth.
The probe is also taking a look at something called space dust. What are we learning about that?
Yeah, space dust. Well, the solar system is a dusty place, and it's not like the dust in your house. This is dust from asteroids and comets and things like that. And since 1929, people had thought that maybe the area around the sun would be relatively dust-free because maybe, you know, the sun would vaporize dust or the actual sunlight could actually push little flecks of dust away. And now the probe is starting to see that. It's seeing the dust thin out as you get closer and closer to the sun.
Help me understand this, because the conditions that close to the sun, they're insane. You know, it's more than 1,000,000 degrees in the sun's corona. The solar winds that we've been talking about are going like 1,000,000 miles per hour, literally. There's very intense radiation, and yet this spacecraft was able to get right up close and personal.
Yeah, well, you know, they've been talking about doing a mission like this for 60 years. And so the technology had to advance to a point where they can do it. And just the heat shield, for example, is really amazing. It sort of looks and feels like a kind of foam. Do you know the sort of florist foam that, like, yep. you know, you put in a pot yeah. and stick flowers in? It looks like that, only it's made totally out of carbon. So it's this sort of really weird new high-tech stuff that's letting them get closer than any spacecraft has before.
I don't think that florist foam would last near the sun for very long. Just saying. This is made out of carbon. By the way, this is also the fastest object ever built by humankind. NASA says it went faster than 153,000 miles per hour on the way to the sun, and it's only getting faster.
Yeah, its top speed is going to be something like 430,000 miles per hour. That's like from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. Wow. in like a second.
All right. So what's next? Because it's going to get closer, as we said.
Yeah, it gets closer and closer over time. The closest approach doesn't come until 2025, and then it will be within 4 million miles of the sun, which sounds kind of far away, but consider that the closest planet, Mercury, is about 36 million miles away. So, you know, it's going to be pretty close.
Cute music, guys. Good job. That's NPR's science correspondent, Nell Greenfield Boyce. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, we're looking at the housing affordability crisis sweeping many cities across the country. And it's not just New York and San Francisco. In mid-sized cities, especially across the West, homeownership is increasingly out of reach. We're going to be looking at markets in Utah, Montana, and New Mexico, where prices are at record highs. But first, we're going to get the big picture from Chris Herbert. He's managing director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Chris, welcome. And what is the state of housing, generally speaking, across the country?
You know, I think one of the biggest, most salient features of the housing market right now across the country is the lack of supply. As we've come out of the recession, the first few years, household growth, the rate at which people were forming independent households was slow. Housing construction was obviously slow as well. But since, the last 5 years, the rate at which people are moving out, forming independent households, looking for housing has really picked up. And we're now running nationally at a rate of about 1.4 million a year. Hmm. And we're just not building that much housing. So last year, we built 1.2 million housing units, not enough to keep up with that demand. And that's putting up great pressure on housing prices.
Why can't we just build more?
You know, there's a host of reasons. One of them has to do with the fact that the lack of labor. So contractors looking for people to, you know, frame houses, hang drywall, do all that. There's not as many workers out there. Another big piece of it has to do with land markets, how hard it is to get a housing development approved, and where you can build the kind of high-density housing that people today are looking for.
And land's expensive, too.
Land is very expensive.
I've been looking at states in the Mountain West, places like Boise, Idaho, Missoula, Montana, Santa Fe, New Mexico. All of these places are facing record high median housing prices, and I'm not sure I understand why. You know, is this something that's happening all over the country, or is something going on specifically in the Mountain West?
A little bit of both. And so I would say, you know, as we were just describing, there's been this enormous increase in demand. Supply is lagged. That's true across the country. So part of what's happening in these markets is that the challenge for developers to keep up with that growth and demand. And in those states in particular, those markets you talked about, are places where there's an enormous increase in demand in particular because they're healthy economies and beautiful places to live.
Well, and plus, are people from other cities like San Francisco, Seattle, really expensive cities, kind of moving into these places and changing the market dynamics?
They are in part. I mean, people are definitely flocking there. Some of them are coming from those West Coast cities. Some are coming from elsewhere. If you look at the employment, particularly in Utah and in Nevada, the share of jobs that are in the tech sector mm-hmm. is high and growing. Those are some of the places where tech jobs have been growing the fastest over the last 8 years. And so that's boosting demand by people who are making good salaries.
Huh. The Santa Fe, New Mexican newspaper pointed out earlier this year that a person earning the city's median salary, $44,000 a year, would have to use 57% of their income to pay the mortgage on a median-priced home. That sounds like a problem, right?
That is a problem. And it's a problem both because try to find a bank who will make you a loan where they're going to have to take that much of your income to get that loan. And the other part of it is coming up with a down payment. And that increasingly is an issue in more and more of these states where house prices are outstripping incomes, making it harder to qualify and much harder to save.
And why can't we just build more affordable housing? We talked about some of the reasons why it's hard to build, generally speaking. But right. Why is it so hard to build affordable? housing?
Well, you know, you mentioned land prices, and I think you really have to start there. And so when you're talking about what does it cost you for a piece of dirt that you're going to be able to put a house on, and depends on what market you're in, that might start at $100,000, $200,000. And then if you add on to that some of the impact fees that places are putting on, you haven't even put a brick or a piece of wood yet, and you've already got a house that's kind of out of reach for a lot of people.
Impact fees are the fees that cities put on developers to pay for things like roads and sewers, that sort of thing.
And schools and all that.
Right. Well, I spoke, in fact, to the mayor of Reno, Nevada in October, who was trying to spur the permitting of 1,000 new homes in 120 days by delaying some of those impact fees. And it does seem like cities in states across the country are trying to, like, you know, shift policy a little bit like that. To your mind, what works? What would be good policy to help this move along?
Well, certainly I think cities have to take a look at the entire process for getting land approved for housing. How difficult is that? How much do developers have to spend in legal fees and others to get through that process? And in particular, what we need now is to make better use of land. And so that means higher density housing. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't have to be high-rise apartment buildings, but if you think about homes that are single-family homes on smaller lots, townhouses, we need what a lot of people refer to as the missing middle housing. So rather than just single-family homes and giant apartment buildings, we need things in between that are more efficient use of land and can be more affordable.
But developers don't want to build those?
Developers would love to build those, but cities have been very restrictive on where they allow that kind of housing to happen.
Mm-hmm. What's it going to take to bring this back into equilibrium, these sky-high record housing prices in cities that frankly don't seem like they should be that expensive? Do you foresee some sort of correction or even a crash in the housing market?
Well, the supply side issues that we've been talking about are difficult. And so the fact that land prices have gone up, the fact that the regulatory process makes it difficult to build, those things are going to be difficult to unwind. The point that may lead to the breaking point is if it becomes so unaffordable that people can't afford to buy those homes, then that will take the winds out of the sail of the market and lead to a fall in prices. Hmm. And ultimately, to the extent that that helps bring land prices down, that could be a good thing. But it's going to mean a lot of pain for people who have already bought at those higher prices.
That's Chris Herbert. He's managing director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
It was great to be with you.
And Chris mentioned tech jobs coming to Utah. Well, the median price of a single-family home in Salt Lake County hit an all-time high this year. It's now above $381,000. And state lawmakers are considering a plan to help people pay their rent as prices soar. Jacob Anderegg is one of the lawmakers proposing that plan. He's a Republican in the state Senate and co-chair of Utah's Commission on Housing Affordability. Jacob, what's driving the cost of housing so high?
We have had such phenomenal growth rates over the last two decades. We've seen the emergence of the Silicon Slopes with a lot of the companies from Silicon Valley relocating here. And I added about 25,000 new residents to my Senate district last year. I'm going to add more than that this year. So it's a significant problem.
But are salaries for, you know, all these new jobs, I guess, if they even exist, are they going up to match home prices?
They are, but not nearly as fast. If you're a transplant, you've got these Silicon Valley companies coming here to Utah, and they're transplanting people, and these transplants are getting paid on average about 380% of average salary wage in Utah County. And that's creating a significant problem because someone will sell their, you know, sixth of an acre in the Bay Area for $2.5 million. They'll come here, they'll see a half acre of land in Lehi, and they'll go, $500,000? Great.
That's nothing.
Yeah, we jump on it.
So that's driving prices up.
Oh, for sure. If you're a developer and a landowner, you're going to want to maximize your returns. So absolutely. It's making it so that especially like college grads, newlyweds, they're finding themselves having to leave the state.
Okay, so you've got an idea. You've got this bill that would create a state voucher program that would help low and moderate income residents pay their rent, people who are not getting these new Silicon Valley type jobs. How would it help? How would that program help?
Well, the biggest issue that we're facing here is an ounce of prevention is worth 10 pounds of intervention. If we can spend $150 to $500 a month on a family being able to stay in their home, that is a fraction of the cost of what it takes for a family to be housed at the homeless shelters. So we're focusing on a multifaceted bill that will provide about $15 million of gap funding for the development of new units. Another 5 million would be for a matching component along infrastructure, let's say transit oriented developments. Mm-hmm. Then a $10 million infusion for rental assistance, and then an additional $5 million for people that have children that are primary aged kids that would qualify for McKinney-Vento, the federal program. We're trying to just help prevent people who are either homeless or on the verge of being homeless to just stay in their homes.
Yeah, I'm doing the math. It sounds like somewhere between $20 to $35 million. I just wonder if that's – is that enough?
Well, it's not, but it's a huge start. Our ongoing infusion of capital on an annual basis has been about $2 million is all. So this is a huge shot in the arm. This would be a big step forward, but it's certainly not going to solve the problem. You know, I'm a conservative Republican, so I don't know that government's going to necessarily solve this problem, but we certainly have a role to play, and we can certainly make sure that we're doing our part, especially with those that are in the most difficult circumstances.
You know, your state has a fund that helps developers build affordable housing, and I see that it ran out of cash by the middle of the year.
So our fiscal cycle starts July 1.
Oh, so it ran out like 2 weeks after it started.
It ran out in 4 days.
Yeah.
That's just the reality of where we're at. The demand is there. It's just we have yet not really, as a state, stepped up to the plate to take on this issue, and that's what we're trying to do.
What's at stake for people in Utah if you can't figure this out?
Well, I mean, what's at stake is either we step up to the plate and we figure out a funding path that can actually start chipping away at this, or we're going to see ourselves having to do emergency funding for more homeless shelter construction, quite literally. I mean, Utah just set up and have just built 3 homeless shelter resource centers. I'm of the mindset that we've got to help prevent more people, more families from becoming homeless, and it's a heck of a lot less expensive to do it through rental assistance than it is by building new shelters and everything that goes along with those.
So there you go. There's a side effect of these rising home prices, people becoming homeless. They can't afford to live in your area. That's Senator Jacob Anderegg, a Republican in the Utah State Senate. He's one of the lawmakers proposing a new rental assistance program in the state as it deals with this rising cost of housing. Senator, thanks very much for talking to us about it.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
And tomorrow, we'll go a little further north to get the view from Missoula, Montana.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Under a new Trump administration rule formalized this week, nearly 700,000 Americans will lose their monthly food stamp benefit known as SNAP. The new rule applies only to able-bodied adults without dependents, and the federal government estimates it will save $5.5 billion over the next 5 years. But already Democrats are blasting the change. Ohio Representative Marsha Fudge called the USDA the Grinch that stole Christmas. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this is about a work requirement to receive SNAP benefits. Officials say that only 7% of the roughly 40 million Americans who get the benefit would be affected. What is changing for this group under the new rule?
Yeah, the administration's targeting able-bodied adults without kids. It's asking them to prove at least 20 hours a week of work to keep receiving those food stamps. And we've seen states so far granting waivers in areas of particularly high economic hardship or if there's been a natural disaster or plant closure. This new rule, which would kick into effect in the spring, just makes it harder for the states to issue those waivers.
The USDA estimates that of those single able-bodied adults who don't have dependents, 74% of them are not working. Why aren't they working in an economy with an unemployment rate so low, the lowest in 50 years, 3.6%?
It's really a ginormous question. The USDA itself says that 17 million people received SNAP benefits back in 2000 when the unemployment rate was 4%. Even with the increase in total able-bodied worker population and where we are today with lower jobless rate, we have 36 million people receiving those benefits. And you have to look at the economic crisis, which slammed not just the unemployed, but the barely employed. They were unable to make ends meet on minimum wage level jobs. I did a story during the crisis on how crowded Walmarts were the instant the clock struck midnight and the SNAP card recharged at the beginning of the month. You shift to the present, even with low unemployment, there's an alarming number of able-bodied men who are just dropping out of the workforce, whether it's opioids or healthcare. It's really bad with people with a high school education or less.
Well, and food stamps are something that have received traditionally a lot of bipartisan support. President Nixon actually expanded the program. George W. Bush did too. When did Republicans start to change their tune on food stamps?
Think back to the Contract with America in the early 1990s and then the GOP revolution of 94. The idea of the kind of the complacent abuser of welfare and food stamps has long, it's been a powerful rhetorical target. And not just to the wealthy, but even middle class workers who they struggle to stay above the poverty line. You saw Bill Clinton co-opt some of that personal responsibility rhetoric into his second term. And it no doubt continues to resonate today, less than a year out from the big election.
Now, the part of the government that deals with food stamps is the USDA. We should also note that as they make these cuts in the program, they're also spending $30 billion or so bailing out farmers to blunt the effects of the trade war with China.
It's unbelievable. It's pretty penny ante if you think about saving $5 or $6 billion over 5 years. The USDA, it's admittedly saying we vastly overestimated how much we have to spend on farmers. One stat, net farm income is on track to total $93 billion this year, a 10% increase over the year before. About 40% of that income will come from the bailout payments and federal subsidies.
You know, and the other thing is that hunger advocates have repeatedly said that the SNAP program, food stamps, is intended to address hunger, not to compel people to work. We will continue to follow this story. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture is accusing the United Kingdom of outright contempt for the rights of a high-profile prisoner, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Niels Melzer said in November that Assange showed all the symptoms typical for prolonged exposure to psychological torture, and more than 60 doctors signed an open letter supporting his claims. Niels Melzer joins us now from Geneva via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on the program.
In a little context, Assange was arrested in April at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He'd been living there for nearly 7 years to avoid a rape charge in Sweden and also really to ultimately avoid extradition to the United States for releasing thousands of classified military reports through WikiLeaks. He is now in a British prison, and that's where I want you to pick this up. When was the last time you saw him, and what condition was he in?
I visited him in Belmarsh prison on the 9th of May. That's about three and a half weeks into his detention there after his arrest on the 11th of April. And I visited him together with two medical experts, a psychiatrist and a forensic expert that are, you know, have been working with examining torture victims for, you know, decades. They can distinguish symptoms that will come from ill treatment from other symptoms, like, you know, they come from a fight or a violent arrest or a sickness, a pre-existing condition.
And what did they tell you about what kind of symptoms they saw in Julian Assange? And what did you see yourself?
Yeah. Well, we had a four-hour slot, two slots of 2 hours. Obviously, I've visited prisons for about 20 years before for the International Committee of the Red Cross in war areas and now as the Special Rapporteur on Torture of the United Nations. So I get a pretty good sense of when I talk to a person whether, you know, there's a genuine issue there. And he reminded me of political prisoners I had visited in countries where they have been subjected to psychological torture. But then we ran medical tests for 3 hours on him, and we followed a specialized medical protocol that's called the Istanbul Protocol, which is designed for the examination of torture victims. And both doctors independently from each other came to the conclusion that he showed all the symptoms that are typical for a person that has been exposed to psychological torture for a prolonged period of time. Now, what we're talking about here is, you know, post-traumatic stress disorders. It's a very elevated level of constant anxiety. It's not the standard anxiety any prisoner would have because he's facing criminal charge or extradition. It really is a debilitating level of anxiety and stress that comes from a profoundly arbitrary environment that is disorienting, destabilizing, and that really deteriorates a person over a period of time.
Right. Now, because he was showing signs of mental and physical deterioration while he was at the embassy. And as you say, you only met with him 3.5 weeks after he was arrested. So where do you think this is coming from? Are we to blame the prison, or are we to blame the situation?
Well, I think that's a very good point you're making, because he had been confined in that embassy because he feared as soon as he steps out of that embassy, he will be extradited to the U.S. And lo and behold, 1 hour after he was arrested by the British, the U.S. actually transmitted their extradition request. So he was right in this fear. And so he was not able to leave that embassy because he feared that his human rights would be seriously violated once he did. So it is clear that he's been exposed to a very limited number of factors that could have caused grave symptoms like that, because symptoms like that don't develop over 3 weeks. They develop over a longer period of time. So I absolutely acknowledge that here we have about four countries, the U.S., the British, the Swedish with their proceedings, and Ecuador, that contributed to that situation in the embassy, which produced those symptoms we observed on the 9th of May. Since then, though, however, we told the British authorities that if the pressure and the arbitrariness of environment doesn't come to an end soon, that his state of health is likely to deteriorate rapidly. And that's exactly what happened. As we predicted, about 9 days after my visit, he was transferred to the healthcare department of the prison. He was no longer able to participate in court hearings. He had to be stabilized medically. And his state of health is now in a downward spiral. And that second part is clearly the responsibility of the British authorities.
Well, and some of the doctors say it's so bad that he could die. Now, Sweden has dropped the rape charges against Assange. But in May, the U.S. Department of Justice filed 17 new espionage charges against him. The extradition hearing is set for February, so that's coming up. Do you think he would be better treated or better off if he were in U.S. custody?
No, I think the public opinion, and it's certainly the opinion of the authorities in the U.S., is profoundly biased against him. I think a narrative has been built around him that really doesn't have any realistic foundation, but that is profoundly hostile. I don't think that there's any chance he will even get a fair trial in the U.S.
That's Niels Melzer, a United Nations rapporteur on torture, speaking with us about Julian Assange and his state of health. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now to France, where schools are closed and the country's high-speed trains sit idle as trade unions protest President Emmanuel Macron's plan to overhaul the French retirement system. Sophie Petter is the Paris bureau chief for The Economist, and she joins us now via Skype. Sophie, first of all, this walkout could include millions of people. Talk about the impact it's having there today.
Well, it has indeed. I mean, the turnout's been massive. We've seen 9 out of 10 trains, for example, run by the National Railways have all been cancelled. We've seen deserted metro platforms because the Paris metro isn't functioning, or at least very few lines are. We've seen, half teachers are on strike, so classrooms have been shut. It has been really massive. And then starting this afternoon, we've seen big demonstrations on the streets of Paris and other cities. So really a very big turnout for this first day of the strike.
And this is all about pension reform. France has one of the most generous retirement systems in the world, actually. Why does President Macron want to change it? What's the plan?
Well, it's an interesting one on two counts, I would say. First of all, what he's trying to do is not to raise the retirement age. The French actually retire very, very young compared with other European countries. The legal minimum is 62 years, and they have such long lifespans that they actually can spend some of them a quarter of a century in retirement. But it's not about that. What it's about is merging what is an absolutely sprawling pension system in France. There are 42 different regimes, all with different rules and different levels of contributions. He wants to transform that into one system that is based on points that everyone can understand and that is fair. And it's that that's causing all the demonstrations. But the second oddity of this is that actually the government hasn't yet announced what the new rules are going to be. So you've got a protest against a reform in principle, but without knowing any of the details. I think people are just really worried.
Now, this is a union strike and a union protest, but how is it connected, if at all, to the Yellow Vest protest from the last year or so?
Well, it's a good question because, in effect, the unions in France have been quite quiet over the last year. The Yellow Vests really did capture both the attention and literally the sort of roads and roundabouts of France a year ago. And they really shook this government and President Macron. And the unions have been quite quiet. So in a way, it marks their return. I think that there is a very strong feeling by a lot of union leaders that they need and want to show that they can still draw these people onto the streets, this many people, that they can still act as a powerful force in France, and that they can still, they hope, force a government to make concessions and even withdraw reform. So, you know, you're looking not just at a sort of a battle of wills between the government and the unions, but a battle for the existence of the unions in France and their real kind of impact on French life today.
You know, we were just watching President Macron on the world stage in London at the NATO meetings this week, showing some pluck, giving President Trump a hard time in public. Now he comes home to this, and he has a challenge on his hands. What do these strikes say about the president's leadership, and is he losing support of the country?
Well, it is difficult for him. He has, a year ago, he was in real trouble when the Yellow Vests were on the streets and his popularity plunged right down. He's recovered it a bit this year. I mean, he launched a whole process of consultations and town hall meetings where he sort of, you know, took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves and really tried to listen to people. And I think that did quite a lot of good for him. And in a way, he's nothing if he's not a reformer. President Macron, that was what he was elected to do. And I think in a way, if he gives in on this one, then he's going to find it very difficult to do anything else in France for the rest of his term in office.
Sophie Petter, Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Peter, it is the holiday season, which means for many people it is time to entertain, have people over, cook for a crowd. But is it possible to do so without breaking the budget? Here and now resident chef Kathy Gunst joins us in the studio with some ideas. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
So you say you don't have to be all fancy with your champagne and caviar and rib roast for a party.
I mean, you can go that way.
You can go there.
Right. Caviar. But you don't have to at all. And you don't have to suffer in the least to do it. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, we're going to have a college party with ramen and a packet and box mac
chips
and cheese.
And salsa,
this is all real food. It's very celebratory. It's ideal for the holidays, but it will not break your bank.
Well, you've got an appetizer here, first of all, a crostini.
I do. So certainly one of the foods that is the least expensive in grocery stores are canned beans or fresh dry beans. So I made a white bean and herb dip. Nice bite there, Peter, with a crostini, a very crunchy. I took some baguette. I sauteed it with some olive oil and let it sit out because you want it kind of crunchy. But the bean dip is so easy. You saute a garlic clove, a little bit of rosemary and thyme in some olive oil, throw it in the blender with a can of beans, a scallion, and lemon juice. And man, there is nothing. This tastes like food you'd get at any delicious restaurant.
That was good. Don't let the sound of it crunch.
The sound is just what
off.
I wanted. Exactly. I like that. That was great.
What about this lasagna?
The lasagna is amazing. So I thought, okay, the anchor of this party has to be something really rich and satisfying because that's what the holidays are all about. This is a spinach and ricotta lasagna. Mm. I will not lie. It's got several elements to it. It takes some time. But here's the deal. The day before your party, you crank that music. If you're into Christmas songs, if you're into holiday music, go for it. Not my thing. But I'd get some real funky energy going. And I spend about an hour making this. But you'll have a beautiful meal for a crowd of people. I took lasagna noodles. I made a ricotta and Parmesan and mozzarella mixture, dried herbs or fresh. Then I made a ricotta bechamel sauce, which is just butter, flour, and milk, and a little bit of nutmeg. And then I sauteed baby spinach, also inexpensive, with garlic, and layered it with a nice tomato sauce. It will take you some time, but it will all be done. And the night of your party, you will be present and you can celebrate.
Well, and I will say that I don't know if it's ever possible with lasagna, but this feels like a healthier lasagna than...
Oh, you are so wrong.
No, it's the spinach. It throws
right,
you off.
Right, the spinach. You focused on the one. It's got a lot of cheese in it.
It doesn't taste healthy, but it tastes good.
You know what? It'll make you happy, so it's healthy. Yeah. And ricotta is relatively inexpensive. Look for cheeses on sale. Look for champagnes or Prosecco, a really great thing to be drinking at the holidays. Mm-hmm. You can find a decent one for well under $10.
Well, speaking of Prosecco, I think you used some in the dessert that you brought.
I used an entire bottle, actually. I did find a very inexpensive bottle of Prosecco that's not too sweet that I loved. And I poached pears, the ultimate seasonal fruit. And then as they were poaching, I just took a bottle of Prosecco, a little bit of water and some sugar, boiled them down, peeled the pears but kept them whole. And then I thought, I want color. So I threw in about half a cup of fresh cranberries, and it gave this Prosecco syrup this gorgeous ruby red. Mm. And it's like everybody's been walking through the cafeteria here looking at those pears going, how hard is it? And I'm like, it's easy. You'll love it. Again, make it a day ahead of time.
But would you make this for a lot of people? Or
sure.
This would be – really?
All you're doing is peeling some pears and throwing them in some bubbling Prosecco and sugar. It's super fast and simple.
While we're talking about alcohol – excuse me.
Are we talking about alcohol,
no,
Peter?
No, Prosecco.
You're fixated on this.
Look, if because when I am throwing a party, I feel like it's necessary, and I want to spend money and invest on the alcohol that I offer to my guests, because I think that's an important part of a party. What about that? Are there corners to be cut on that?
Well, there definitely are.
You don't want to look cheap.
You don't want to look. Okay, there's two ways to go about this. One is to go in and not buy the highest end label and to say to somebody, what's a good deal? What's comparable to my favorite champagne or vodka or whatever you're drinking? The other thing is, ask for a BYOB for your bottles. Let everybody bring their favorite bottle of wine. There is nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with having a holiday potluck. But these three dishes come together to put a holiday meal on the table that's every bit as good as that classic sort of rib roast caviar thing, which at this point, people are tired of.
How much entertaining are you doing this December?
I am going on a trip to my daughter's wedding, so I'm going to be off the hook. But I did quite a bit of cooking over Thanksgiving. Of course, I adore this. I would do this once a week if we had a holiday.
Well, and do people still come over to your house and all they want to do is play with your pizza oven, or have you play with your pizza oven?
It's buried under a lot of snow right now. But, that's the other thing I would say is the more love you put into your holiday cooking, it shows up on the plate.
No matter what you serve, right, people, this is about your friends and your family. So don't worry about the price tag.
And just have fun. And that's why I love all three of these dishes, is that you can take your time and do it the day ahead.
We've got all these recipes and Kathy's tips for inexpensive holiday entertaining at hereandnow.org. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.